Welcome to After Hours at the Book Club. It's a podcast only edition of our radio book club, which is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio in Boulder and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. My co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian, the head buyer at the Boulder Bookstore. This month, a Colorado pick. It's a murder mystery that's set in a northern Colorado town, a fictitious one, Girl in Snow. It's the first book by our guest, Dania Kukavka. And you grew up in Fort Collins, which is very much a real town, but you've set this in a fictitious town kind of close to Fort Collins. What reaction are you getting from readers in that part of the world?
So Broomsville is a fake town somewhere on the Front Range. I imagine it's kind of somewhere near Broomfield or Louisville, but it's much smaller than any of the actual towns. So people have been excited that there's a book set in Colorado because it's actually pretty rare. So I work in the publishing industry and I read a lot of books that come in on submission, and many, many books are set on the East Coast. And people have been genuinely so excited that a book is set in Colorado. It's not necessarily the travel ad for Colorado, but
it seems a little bit miserable.
Yeah,
but we know what it's like, really.
So right,
that's why we like it, because like it won't convince anybody to move here.
Right,
so it's perfect. So you mentioned that you're in publishing. You mm-hmm. work for Riverhead, one yes. of the top publishers in the country. What do you do with it for them?
So I'm an assistant editor at Riverhead Books. So I work on my boss's books closely with many of her authors. She publishes, you know, Paul Hawkins, Khaled Hosseini, Emma Straub, Helen Oy, Emmy Lauren Groff, Meg Walzer, many amazing, amazing authors. So it is a really great job. I get to work on the books that I would pick up in the bookstore anyway. And I'm also acquiring my own list at Riverhead. So I'm looking to bring new voices.
Maybe some Colorado voices.
I hope
so. We've had a lot of great Colorado mm-hmm. authors on. So Riverhead did Paul Hawkins, you know, and mm-hmm. she's kind of a thriller that was a huge book. And your book is published by Simon & Schuster, but it's kind of given that treatment. When I bought the book, it was like the lead title on the list.
It's great.
And so how does that feel being on both sides of the business, seeing like, you know, how a writer like Paul Hawkins gets their break with Riverhead and goes crazy? That book sold like, you know, millions of copies.
Mm-hmm.
But and then the same to realize that, hey, Simon & Schuster is treating me that way.
Yeah, it has been a wild ride, I will say that. It's been really amazing to be on both sides because I get to watch how authors deal with these processes before I'm going to go through them, which has been really nice. And, I watched many other debut authors go through the process. An author who I really admire, whose book sold a few months before mine and came out last year, is Britt Bennett. Mm-hmm. She wrote The Mothers, and it's a wonderful book, and she's also very young. And watching her handle that so gracefully, the whole process of being a debut author, was really great for me, because I sort of thought, well, here's what's coming for me. I can do it. She could do it. I can do it. She's like lovely and normal and cool, and I can remain a normal person. So that has been the great side of working and writing. It is hard, of course, you know, even just to find the time to write while working a full-time job. It's something a lot of people struggle with.
Well, you have all those voices in your head too, right? You're reading everybody else's work.
Yes.
And as an editor, I imagine you're thinking about in a very deep way, how can I make this better? Or what can I tell the author to help with this? But at the same time, you might have to work out issues in your own book, right?
Exactly. And one of the most helpful things that I've learned doing both is that as an editor, what you're looking for is to find a book that you can really fall into, right? You're completely submerged by this book. You're living in the world of the book. And as a writer, you're trying to reach that exact same point. You're just coming at it from the other side. So that has been really helpful to my writing. When I sit down to write, I imagine myself or my boss trying to fall into the book and failing sometimes. And that's when revision happens, yeah.
So for aspiring writers or mm-hmm. maybe longtime writers who are looking to get a break with a company like Riverhead, I mean, how does it work? Do you need an agent, or do you literally send a manuscript? Do you send just like three chapters? Do you have to have an entire book published? And how might it end up on a desk of somebody like yourself?
You need an agent. You always need an agent, at least for a place like Riverhead or Simon & Schuster. And that's the first step. And the first step is finishing a book. A lot of people, send out queries, which is like a submission letter, basically. and they say, you know, I'm writing a novel, it's not finished yet, and an agent will see that and immediately say, no, you have to finish it first, if it's fiction, at least. Nonfiction works a little differently. But for fiction, you have to have the whole book, and that is the first step. And then you send a letter to an agent, probably a lot of agents, and it goes from there, and then the agent sends the book to the editors.
It's got to be a good letter, right? I mean, yes. you're a writer, so yeah. You got to write a really good letter.
Yeah, it has to be a good letter, and it has to be concise and within the parameters of what the agency likes as per their website. So,
did it help, do you think, to get people's attention by being in the business, by being with Riverhead? Did that help you land an agent?
I hope so.
and did that help sell the book, I wonder?
You know? I hope so, yeah. I mean, there are certain things. You know, I work on Paula Hawkins' books at Riverhead, and I have a blurb from Paula Hawkins on the front of my book, which is amazing. And in that sense, I think it's just my genuine all-day, everyday love for books and reading that has gotten me to that point. So yeah, it's been really exciting to see everyone in the industry sort of take hold of this book, and it's... At one of my events in Brooklyn, someone said, it's like a marriage of Riverhead and Simon Schuster. A beautiful marriage.
So Paul Hawkins was Girl on a Train, yes. Right? Yeah, and that was a huge book. Mm-hmm. What did, when you first saw that book, yeah. before it went through the publishing process early on, did you realize it was something like that, this could be dynamite? Or was it something that took you by surprise a little bit?
So I actually started at Riverhead the week The Girl on the Train came out.
Okay.
So I wasn't already there for the editorial process. But I remember thinking, like, oh, number one New York Times bestseller, I guess that's cool. Little did I realize it's very cool. Yeah.
Do you often get that aha moment when you get a manuscript and you're like, this is it?
Yes.
This is going to be absolutely it.
Yes. And that's when you know. And those are the moments that you live for as an editor, where you're reading a book and you're like, this, I can do so much with this. And this needs to be a book. And here's why. And here's how we're going to talk about it.
Do you have some that have come out you can tell us that you felt that way about?
Yes. Let me think. What is coming out now? Actually, Gabriel Talent's My Absolute Darling is coming out in a couple of weeks. That book came into my boss right around when my book sold. And I remember saying, like, you know, I'll try to read with you this week, but I'm very distracted, like emotionally distracted. And she gave me Gabriel's book and said, let's look at this. And I was just hooked. It is incredible. So that one I'm really excited about, and his voice is so special, and the writing is incredible, and also it tells this page-turning and very harrowing story of a teen heroine who is really like a classic hero. So,
and we're going to have him on the on the radio show and the podcast in a couple months. It's not the next one coming up, but we're going to have Gabriel on, and I met him at Book Expo, and he seems like a great guy and very interesting, and his mother's at least within writing circles, his mother's a famous writer.
Yes.
Elizabeth Talent.
Yes. Yeah, he's very lovely. I think you guys will have a great time.
You said in the Radio Book Club edition that this actually kind of started as a young adult novel, because it was from the perspective, at least initially, one teenager, and then another teenager was added. And then, of course, the character who was killed is a teenager as well. So it seems to have all the hallmarks of a YA book. Did you have it in your head that it was a YA book when you were writing it?
I thought I had written a YA book, yes. And I think the line is so blurry between YA and adult literature that there are so many books that are beloved by adults that could be categorized as YA books. And some of those are my absolute favorites. So if you've read any books by Megan Abbott, she takes teenage lives very seriously, and she writes really scary thrillers about teenagers. Another one of my favorites is Everything I Never Told You by Celeste Ng. I think that book does fantastic work giving real lives to teenagers and making sure the book is still for adults. The Lovely Bones, Never Let Me Go. There are a lot of classics that actually do this and do it really well. So
I often wonder about that. And we've had a YA author on the book club. And, you know, we've talked about why something's categorized YA. And so much of it really is marketing. And I often wonder, if you get it wrong and if you categorize it in the wrong way, either as YA or just regular fiction, that you could really send it down the wrong road. You know what I mean? I mean, you have a huge amount of influence on ultimately who gets to read this book.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there are whole teams behind it deciding who it's going to be marketed towards. And I may write a YA book someday, but for now I'm very in the adult sphere.
But you're very good at that inner life of the teen.
Thank you.
Did you draw on your own experience because you're not that far away from teenage years,
right?
And you're so young yourself. Was it still fresh in your memory, especially some of those just oh my god moments where you describe Cameron who's looking at Lucinda and Jade, and just mm-hmm. that we've used angst mm-hmm. so much as a word. I can't think of anything else to better yeah. describe just what they're going through.
Right. So I started this book when I was 19, and I didn't think I could write about adults. I just, you know, I didn't think I knew enough to write about adults. And since I still probably don't know enough, but I did write about an adult, and I think it went okay.
Well, Jade in this book, she, you know, just the body image issues mm-hmm. that are, I mean, not that you don't have body image issues through your whole life, but sometimes as a teenager, that's all you have. I mean, it seems like right. that just all encompassing. And so I thought you captured that well.
Thank you. And that's what I love about teenagers, too, is their problems are so big to them, right? There's no shame in feeling how you feel. Well, there's plenty of shame often, but to yourself, you know, your emotions are your whole life. And those things that you feel are much bigger than they are in adulthood.
And you touch on teenage sexuality a little bit, mm-hmm. but really it's more other emotions, which I valued, because I think often a lot of when we read about teens, it's very focused on the sexuality mm-hmm. and what they're doing, as opposed to necessarily what they're right. feeling. And there were a couple of scenes where, you know, there's obviously, you know, some of them are having a sex life, but really what resonated with me was just that the emotions and just their, as you said, they're so big to them. It's so yeah. all-encompassing.
Right. It's been funny. I've had a couple of, you know, online reviewers, like Goodreads reviewers and stuff, saying, like, oh, how dare she write about sex with 15-year-olds.
But you said barely, and it's not explicit.
I know, and I sort of, like, wanted to say, you know, you think your 15-year-old's not thinking about sex. I'm sorry.
You know, one of the things I liked about Cameron, though, you know, here he is stalking Lucinda. He's worshiping her. He even watches her masturbate on one night. You know, that's one of the more explicit scenes. But I thought, you know, here's a boy. He's about like 15 or so, 16. He wasn't really ready for a sexual relationship. He's willing to think about a girl. He's willing to look at it, but he's not. It's almost like it's okay. I mean, at that age, to not be ready.
Right.
And I mean, he's not ready in a weird way. It's maybe not okay to not be ready for sex, but to stalk. I mean, that's not the best outlet.
Right.
But I thought it was interesting to have a character that he wasn't really ready. And that almost made him, almost helped me forgive him for this kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he can't approach her. It's just not within him at this point.
Right. And there is a scene with his friend Ronnie, who's very crude. And Ronnie is talking about the girls from school, and he says, well, how would you have sex with her? Like, what kind of sex, you know? And they're like weird teenage vocabulary. They didn't even know how to talk about it. And Cameron's like, what? Why? No. Oh, I guess from behind. Like, I don't know. So, and he's kind of repulsed by it, even though he is having all these feelings that he just can't name.
And then Jade as well. I mean, she is just dealing with just the worst kind of body issues. She can't even be naked in the shower because right. she can't even stand to look at her own body. How do you get into that kind of mindset? Because that is such a deep, dark hole to fall down that, you know, so many young people are in.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody at that age has some version of that, right? You have the thing that you're like, you know, I'm like horrified by myself in this specific sense, and very often for teenage girls it's physical, right? And Jade really embodies that idea. Yeah.
When I was reading it, I was so glad that I wasn't a teenager, right? And that I will never be a teenager again. And it made me so scared for my kids. I mean, Arson and my kids are kind of the same age, a few years away from being a teenager, but it's like, oh my god, they gotta go through all of this.
It's horrible, isn't it?
I'm like, she's growing up too fast. Can we just pause the button at 8 for a while, maybe 5
and
years?
Then fast forward to 21.
I need an extra 5 years to prepare for her being a teenager.
And it seems to be getting worse, and obviously social media is a huge part of this, and I know the book is deliberately set in 2005 because we don't have to deal then with Facebook and Instagram and everything, because that's its own entity there. And so, you know, they're dealing just with their own emotions, never mind putting it out there for the whole world to feel. But it seems like it's getting harder and harder and harder to be a teenager instead of getting easier, which is what you think should happen with evolution, right? It's supposed to, we're supposed to make life easier.
Right. I cannot imagine being a teenager right now. I mean, I was a teenager in 2005, which is why I said the book in 2005, because I know that world. And they have so many more tools to be teenagers now. I can't imagine.
Have you heard from teenagers? And we know it's not a YA book, mm-hmm. but very often, as we said, you know, adults or young adults will often cross over the genres. And I know how deeply young readers can attach themselves to books, especially when they really, when a character really resonates with them. I know the book is just coming out now, but do you anticipate that? I mean, I can imagine.
I hope that some
people reading
mature,
this would really, yeah.
Yeah, I hope some mature teen readers will love the book. It's definitely not for younger teens, but I think absolutely if there are teens who are reading adult novels in general, they might really like this one.
Yeah, I think they would latch on to Jade especially. Cameron's a little out there. I mean, I think he's a very interesting character and you sympathize with him, and I like those sections of the book, but I can't quite see a teen knowingly identifying with Cameron in the same way you could with Jade.
Although having said that, the voyeuristic tendencies of Cameron now play in a completely different way on social media platforms.
And that's true.
We talked about that earlier. In many ways, it's easier now to be a voyeur because you have all of that access. People are putting them a version of themselves out there for everyone to see, and you can kind of creep around as much as you want and consume that.
Yes. And Lucinda's dad, who at one point comes out and says, "Hey, you, like, get away, get off my lawn." You know, you can't do that with social media. You know, there's no even if it was ineffective in the book of protecting Lucinda from Cameron's gaze, you can't even do that much as a parent.
I found the book very cinematic. I mean, I could really visualize all of this and really get a sense of what all of these characters would look like. I mean, is it too soon to talk about a movie version of this? I mean, given the way the book industry goes, I mean, so often the movie rights are sold at the same time, right?
Yeah. So I have signed with a film agent out in LA, but we have not sold the rights yet. Hoping someone wants to make it. We'll see. People have sort of asked, like, you know, who would you cast? And I'm like, oh, nobody cute.
Except Lucinda.
Right, Lucinda can be cute, but the rest of them are not cute.
Inez.
Yeah.
You know, Russ's wife, who we haven't really talked about, who it's almost like a marriage of convenience to some extent. Mm-hmm. And then it seems to grow into some form of love, and then it falls apart. I thought that was one of the most interesting parts of the book. Inez is going... is in this relationship, and at one point Jade asks her, like, what's it like to be loved that much? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was such a honest and open moment that maybe you couldn't have anybody but a teen ask that kind of question.
Right. And, you know, Jade almost doesn't even realize she's asking that question because she's writing it in her alternative life in her head, right? And
she's got a whole screenplay. Jade has a movie,
right?
She's writing
Jade's
a movie.
Writing a movie.
The whole book.
Yeah. So Jade's writing a screenplay of things that she wishes were happening to her. It's called Things You Want to Say But Can't Without Being a Dick. And she reimagines, like, every moment in her life in the way that she wants it to go. And her screenplays allow her to be vulnerable in ways that she would never be vulnerable in her actual world.
But that was one where they crossed, and she actually said what was in the screenplay before she even knew she had said it in a way.
Yes.
And Inez gives her an honest answer, or at least considers it honestly.
Yes.
And then Cameron has his own outlet, I suppose, in his art, because he documents everything, I mean, that he witnesses, he draws it, and he's an amazing artist. Who did the cover?
The cover was done by a designer named Alex Merto, and the art director at Simon & Schuster is named Allison Forner. I love the cover. I think it's so evocative of the feeling of the book. Cameron is an artist, a visual artist, and he really perceives the world through the context of anatomy, I think, in a lot of ways. That's kind of his obsession, you know? He both his mother and Lucinda are ballet dancers, and he can draw people realistically from memory, and that's how he knows what's true and what isn't.
As you read so many books for your job, mm-hmm. like, how many books would you read a week? I mean, and do you ever get to read for pleasure, or is it just like, I got 10 books to read by Friday, but I wish I could read these books if I only had an extra 5 days in a week?
Yes, I always do have 10 books I should read by Friday, but I make a point to try to read a book that's not for work once a week or once every 2 weeks, just because I think it's so important to keep an eye on what's coming out. And also because it's so enjoyable and you forget why you're reading if you're just reading for a job all the time.
And did you always want to be a writer? And you're a reader too. I mean, you get both the best of both worlds.
Yes, I always did.
Do you think you'll keep editing if this book takes off, or are you going to, you know, hey, here's my 2 weeks notice?
No, the plan is to continue editing. I think it's really nice. I mean, even just on a daily basis, so many writers sit at their desks all day and torture themselves. And I sit at my desk and torture myself for an hour and then I go to work and I have a normal day.
Mm-hmm. And torture writers.
Right, exactly.
Well, you're so lucky to be at Riverhead. You know, mm-hmm. I've been buying books now at the Boulder Bookstore for 20 years. I mean, they do Juno Diaz. They did Exit West, which is an excellent book I read earlier this year. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just New People is coming out. Yep. But I thought that was an amazing book. Mm-hmm. And that there's a voyeuristic thing going on in that book, too. I don't know if you worked on that one or not.
No, that was a different editor.
That was a different editor.
But I've heard it's amazing.
But so to have the Riverhead list to read, you are so lucky. It's the great fiction, great nonfiction. Anne Lamott is mm-hmm. Elizabeth Gilbert is a Riverhead author. You have so many great authors there. I mean, it's not like you're editing, you know, McGraw-Hill's, you know, educational manuals or something, right?
Right. So. And they are very... creative. They have a creative life force, which is why they publish the books that they do. The outlook there is very much like, you know, we are trying to bring the best books into life. And part of being an editor there is being allowed that creativity, which is, I know, a very special gift.
And having been an editor at one book publisher, did that help the process of you then being a writer with an editor somewhere else?
Yes, definitely. I knew what to expect. I know generally how author-editor relationships look. And so I'm very appreciative also for my editor because I know exactly how hard she's working. I know exactly what she's doing. And she's like just busting it for me. And I'm very, very appreciative.
And when you think back at the early drafts of the book, I mean, mm-hmm. when it was just a book with Cameron and now where mm-hmm. it is now, I mean... Do you sometimes wish maybe there's still a book out there just for Cameron, or there's a book out there just for Jade?
I think it's over. I think I've done this story. So yeah, I don't plan to revisit any of the characters. I think this book could have gone in a lot of different directions, but I'm happy with how it turned out.
Well, Girl in Snow is the first novel by Dania Kukafka, and she's been our guest on After Hours at the Radio Book Club. Catch the full interview where we really do focus on the book Girl in Snow at the Radio Book Club on iTunes, and you can find out more at news.kgnu.org. Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU.